what brings people to a religious practice such as we do is something that has two aspects. One of them is that there's something you're looking for, that you have an intuitive sense you're drawn to, and this seems to offer a pathway to what you're looking for. The other thing is that you're aware that you're suffering in some way. You're aware of the fact of suffering to some degree or other, and you want that suffering to stop. If you don't have both of these, then and to a considerable degree, then basically you're not ready to do this. You're not ready for serious meditation practice. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's no judgment implied in what I just said. No value judgment. It's an observable fact that in a world with some 6 or 7 billion people, only a tiny, tiny percentage of them do a really serious contemplative practice. In a world with hundreds of millions of Buddhists, only a small percentage of them do a regular meditation practice. So, it's a big world. There's many paths. This path is a very focused, it is the most focused religious path, the contemplative path. And that may sound swollen-headed, but, all I can say is, I didn't invent it. I just, do it and benefit from it, I hope. So I'm just going to reveal one thing at a time here to keep it simple. I just go down a list here. There's a pleasure written in black and pain written in red. When you sit down to meditate, you're looking at that wall, there's a number of things that will be in your consciousness. But let's just simplify it to the two chief elements. One of them is what you think of as your thoughts. And a lot of that will be in verbal form. Some of it won't be, maybe. But what's in verbal form is more identifiable for us because we're raised with language. And the other is your feelings. And sometimes the thought side's more in ascendancy, and sometimes the feeling side is more in ascendancy. If the thought side is very much in ascendancy, it means that the feeling side is really, there's something blocked in the feeling side. In other words, if you're spending the whole time, you're just running around in your head. It means that there's something you're trying not to feel. The feeling side is deeper, more immediate than the thought side. And more basic to our constitution as living beings than the thought side. The feeling side has two aspects. One aspect is a pleasure aspect. Another aspect is pain. With many feelings that you have, not all feelings, with many feelings, one of these is dominant. If you're feeling fear, grief, anger, worry, the just a pure emotion, those are painful states. If you're feeling happiness, joy, contentment, I'm just talking about the feeling, pure feeling. Security, feeling of security. Those are pleasurable. Again, no judgment. Okay, no judgment. No good and bad here. At this level, it's just This is just the way we experience things, isn't it? So you sit down on that cushion, you're looking at the wall. Your toe starts itching, you don't like it. Why don't you like it? Well, in some ways it's painful. You know, physical feeling. You're sitting there. You have this wave of fear hit. Pure emotional pain. You're sitting there. There's this kind of bright sense of joy. Bright, joyful sense. Pleasurable. See? Your meditation functions as a little mirror within which what is going on in you shows itself. By one of the scriptures that we do at morning service called the most excellent mirror, samadhi. Samadhi is a word meaning meditation. When we sit down there, what's going on in us can show itself because we're just being still for a while there. So what's within us can bubble up to the surface and come into consciousness. We're not trying to do six things at once. We're just stuck there on that seat or the cushion. Stuck in front of the mirror. When we're wildly running around our head, we're trying very hard not to look in the mirror. That itself is painful, actually. Painful effort. There's this quality of pain that goes with it. So, if you're a living being and you have nerves, you have physical nerves, and you have a brain and organs, and like if you're a material being, this stuff you can't avoid. Pleasure and pain, you can't avoid it. And if you wanted to avoid it, then meditation really isn't for you. Because you can't avoid it, and meditation will make it really clear to you that you can't avoid it. Feeling, it's said in Buddhism that feeling is the reaper of karma. And that means that whatever you have done in your past life, whatever you have inherited from previous lives, in the nature of choice that has been made that has moral implications, free choice having moral implications, you will experience the consequences of that one day in terms of pure states of feeling. And this is part of what's called law of karma again, and it is viewed by Buddhists, and I can tell you from experience, is, as my teacher said, an inexorable truth. In other words, it's something we can do nothing about. We can't do anything more about that than we can about gravity. Whether we like gravity or not, it functions. Whether we acknowledge that it exists or not, it exists. If we defy it and go walking off a cliff, we end up dead. If we defy the law of karma, we end up in a lot of spiritual trouble. And in all the more intense states of feeling, there is this element of pleasure and pain. There's some feelings which are just kind of neutral, you know, not much of either. But all the more intense ones, it's one or the other usually. Sometimes a complex mixture. So we're going to do a little journey now based on pleasure and pain here, on feeling really. I haven't written the word feeling down. It's really based on feeling. So I'm trying to reveal only one thing at a time, which is some of you already know what's coming more or less, but see. The next pair I have is liking and disliking. The red ones go with the pain. The black ones go with the pleasure aspect. And things are even more complex than that, because if you have someone who's a masochist, they derive some kind of satisfaction from pain. We're going to leave that kind of complexity out of it for the moment. But, you know, things are always more complex than they're laid out to be. So let's just accept that fact and lay it out simply here. Because you get too complex and you're off in the toolies. Spend all the time out, you know, in the boondocks, and never, you know, get to have a progression, you know, of the talk. It didn't go anywhere in the end. So liking and disliking. Liking and disliking are based on pleasure and pain. Liking and disliking are based on pleasure and pain. We tend to like the things that are pleasurable and satisfying. We tend to dislike the things that are painful and not satisfying. And if you just think in terms of the body, well, that's a good thing. You know, if you were to go bite a newt, you'd probably find it to be very unpleasant tasting. You know, newts don't have a defense other than the fact that, you know, they're very slow, they're soft-bodied. If they weren't kind of toxic, which is what they are, they'd be on everyone's top of the list for eating, but mostly they're left alone. And they probably have a bad flavor that goes with that toxicity, I would imagine. Have you ever eaten a newt? No, me either. I'm not going to either, being a vegetarian, but, you know, there's a lot of plants that are like that too, bitter tasting. Bitter tasting often means, you know, this could be poisonous. And I had that about green beans when I was a kid. But so there's a good physical basis to this, and it's survival related. But of course, we're not just physical beings, and there's a spiritual aspects of liking, disliking too. We prefer to be praised generally than to be blamed. We prefer to be loved and cherished rather than to be hated. Most of us would prefer to be liked and honored rather than to be feared. But some people get in their head that it's actually better to be feared than to be liked and honored, and you get a Stalin. With regard to morality, liking and disliking are totally value neutral, as are pleasure and pain. You can no more help liking and disliking than you can help being a being who feels pleasure and pain. No, I can't will myself into becoming a being who doesn't like ice cream, because every time I have another bite of ice cream, I'm reminded I really like this stuff. You see? Similarly, I can't will myself into being a being who enjoys feeling fear. See? I don't enjoy feeling fear. Although, God knows I had enough experience, I mean, you'd think I'd love it by now. A whole lifetime of feeling fear. But no, I don't. I still don't enjoy it. And I still feel it at times. I don't feel it like I used to feel it, the same intensity, or the same, you know, for years, incredible intensity at times. I don't tend to have that anymore. But it hasn't, you know, I work a lot with a chainsaw, you know, my God, you know, if you don't have a healthy respect for that saw, I mean, that thing scares me. That's helping me not cut off a limb. Well, so far, anyway. Do I really want to just be rid of that fear? No, actually, I want to make right use of it. And still, I don't like the feeling if I get a big wave of the feeling. And that doesn't mean anything wrong with me. I'm a functioning human being, a functioning animal, which is human beings are just a glorified animal. I mean, we're the ones who glorify us. The rest of the animal kingdom has other thoughts, probably. But so this is, you know, liking and disliking are value neutral. It's what you do with them. It's what you do with them. So let's move down from liking and disliking. Some of you will recognize dependent origination in this. Now we have wanting, and wanting more of pleasure and wanting less of pain. See, wanting goes going two ways. You can also call it wanting to have something and wanting to avoid something. But let's just talk about wanting for a minute. Wanting also is value neutral. If your body needs food and you don't want to eat, how are you going to know that that you need to eat? The hunger is a message being sent by your body to your will to get on and get some grub so the body can survive and be healthy. You know, or as healthy as it's capable of being in the circumstances. You know, what could be wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with it. The experience of wanting, unsatisfied wanting, is one of the things that is painful. The experience of satisfaction of wanting is one of these things that is pleasurable. And that's all, that's just fine. So here's where we get to the aspect of that has to do with morality. Must have, must avoid. So I've just gone from wanting, and here's the step. In dependent origination, this is called the difference between craving and clinging. For those of you who know the teaching of dependent origination. So dependent, when I use that kind of technical sounding term, that's just a detailed explanation of how the law of karma works. But there's a big difference between simple wanting and the must-having. And what is it that's added here? Well, there's two fundamental elements that are added here. And one of them is added, is created through time. And that is called the habit energy of karma. And that is where, over a period of time, a living being or a series of living beings develop a habit in a certain direction of that reinforces wanting and makes it more and more powerful until it has a kind of a what you call in kind of secular terms an addictive quality. And that is caused by certain repeated actions, and that addictive quality is a consequence of the repeated actions. And this is where the element of moral choice starts to really show its head clearly. To put it in another term, in other terms, it's very familiar to people who studied Buddhism very much. We literally, through our actions, make ourselves to be the kind of person we are, with the kind of strong desires and even addictive kind of behaviors that we tend to have. And we all can kind of fill in the blanks here on what, on, you know, how we go about this. But when you kind of probe beneath the surface very far, you usually find that the issue of love is in some way fundamental to the formation of powerful urges. The issue of love is fundamental to the formation of powerful urges. I'm not here speaking of love just as a feeling. I'm speaking of a fundamental need that we have, a spiritual need to love and to know that we are loved. In the talk that I've done till now, I've really been talking at a very kind of superficial level with regard to the spiritual life of being. And now with the introducing the concept of love, I've shown something, or started to try to reveal something about what underlies that more spiritual or that more superficial level, what's actually the creative force behind it. In other words, where our very existence is derived from ultimately. And it's from love. We don't know it, and you can't prove it. We don't see it with our senses, and you can't prove it scientifically. But love is actually what we're made of. It's not just a commodity that is traded between beings, as is so often treated in more superficial views of what love is. But love is actually what we're made of. And the need for love is fundamentally the need to be entirely in harmony with what we're really made of. To be entirely in harmony with that. To have our actions, our thoughts, our entire life in harmony with that. And if you think of that love as a capital L love, not a small L love. You can call it, as we do in Buddhism, the Buddha nature or the eternal or the cosmic Buddha. You can call it God. You can call it whatever you want. The truth is, whatever we call it, however we think of it, it is. And this, the pleasure and pain, the liking, disliking, the wanting, the even the must-having and the must-avoiding, they're all rooted in it. It's this that it's not until the must-having and the must-avoiding that it really, it's not until you're actually dealing with your life on the level of the must-having and the must-avoiding that the issue of love in the deepest spiritual sense begins to become a fundamental importance to you. Or begins to come into focus, is maybe a better way to put it, in your life. Let's just move on from there. I don't remember how many more of these I got. I got a couple more. The next one I have here is, I am the kind of person who blank. I am the kind of person who blank. And this covers both the black and the red. I've written in black, but it covers both. And this is a progression from this must have and must avoid to a full-blown delusion, basically. The delusion of self. I'm not the kind of person who can tolerate that. I'm the kind of person who has to have this. I'm the kind of person who has to be this way. I can't put up with this kind of person because this kind of person, I can't deal with them. I can't deal with this situation. I can't. I must have, I must not have self, the problem of self. And it is in the problem of self that the full flames of our suffering get revealed, really. It's in the problem of self that the real flames of suffering get exposed. Trying to defend self, which is an illusion, really. Trying to defend an illusion. Try to aggrandize a delusion. Trying to have more for self. Trying to avoid more for self. I'll just go on to the next one, which is just a continuation of the same. Now I can get rid of this cover sheet here. So we have the last one here in the series. This is good, this is evil. This is good, this is evil. This is Buddha, this is not Buddha. Now I'll just use to kind of illustrate how this works. I'll use myself as an example, because if you use yourself as an example, then you're always safer than if you think of someone else, because that person might actually be in the room or something and know what he's thinking of me. So I'll use myself as an example. So I do a lot of forestry work. This is kind of my unofficial temple job, and really kind of just a way to try to keep my sanity. I don't think I succeed all that well, but I have fun. And one of the things I do is I try to keep back the invasive weeds, which for us mostly means Scotch broom. So suppose I'm out, like I was yesterday morning with some of our friends here, you know, pulling up Scotch broom. Well, you know, when you're face of the whole mess of Scotch broom there, and it's hard work getting out, you start really wishing, you know, I wish the hell the damn stuff would just be gone. You know, what's that? But that's the good and evil, isn't it? This damn stuff, I wish it'd just be gone. See, what is that but denying Buddha nature? Who is it that just wants it? It's just me. You know, what right do I have to say this stuff shouldn't be here? Aren't I just playing God there? You can trace it right back through here. You know, my pleasure in the natural forest, in the natural meadow area, and my pain at the prospect of the meadow being overrun by an invasive weed. A non-native plant, you know, and crowding out all the other things and the effect on the wildlife and the like. Until I've gone through the liking and disliking it, the wanting to not be there, wanting something else to be there in its place, the must have, the must not have, or the must avoid, that I'm the kind of guy who goes after the Scotch broom to the, you know, that evil damn stuff. Where's my blowtorch? You know, where's my flamethrower? Okay. So how can I pull the Scotch broom up without doing that? Okay, how can I pull this? Because what does that lead to? Well, what kind of person does that make me? What kind of person does that make me in the end? Makes me a wee bigot. You know, a plant bigot. Really? Do I want to be that kind of person? Do I want to be the kind of person when I'm driving down the road and I see this beautiful Scotch broom blooming, the Scotch broom blooming, I see that beautiful, those beautiful flowers, and all I can think is, this awful stuff, why can't they get rid of it? And this is what happens. This is ideology. That's environmental ideology. And it's just ideology. It's plant Nazism. It really is. So, given the fact that in some sense, the scotum actually does need to be kept back. Not eradicated off the planet, because in its own situation, you know, it's wonderful. But it thrives in this situation at a cost to the rest of the plant and animal life. So how do I go about it? Well, I've got to start right back up here. And I've got to be watching my own reactions. And when I start to go into the more and more dualistic approach, I've got to be able to stop myself. And how do I do that? What tool do I have spiritually to do that with? Well, I can meditate, and when I meditate, if I notice I'm obsessed by hatred for Scotch broom, well, that's a little signal, isn't it? So I've got to start backing off in my attitude, working on my attitude. But in the situation where I'm actually going out to pull the Scotch broom, what can I do? Well, one thing is I can do is I can actually do a little bow each time I pull a plant. Maybe I won't do a physical bow, but I can work at doing a little mental bow each time I pull a plant. There's the Scotch broom Buddha. There's a weed Buddha. There's the action of pulling the weed that is the work of Buddha pulling Buddha. There's, you know, blessing rather than hating. In other words, I can work at turning something around. If I have that attitude, and if I don't have that dualistic attitude, I can work at not developing it, not taking those steps that, frankly, most people in the world are not conscious they're taking, but just live with constantly, 24 hours a day, live with the consequences of having amassed so much suffering and confusion with regard to this process. They're completely unaware that they're actually the victims of their own ways of thinking. And own ways of doing things. This training is incredibly difficult in some of its aspects, and at times brings you face to face with your deepest fears and your deepest pain. But what it offers you is freedom from being always the person who's kicking your own butt and not knowing it. So, for the last part of this talk, I've used quite a simple example, but don't think that simple example won't apply to everything, because it does. It's a kind of a... It does apply, the same principle applies. So let's talk about something that it applies to that's a lot harder for us to get a handle on than the one I just talked about for most of us. Let's just talk about people who experience waves of intense fear, and they actually don't know where they're coming from. They don't know how they were created. It just seems like one day in your life, all of a sudden, you started to feel at times it's kind of overwhelming fear. I had this, and I talk about this from time to time. It's one of them I can use. I can use others, too. I could use anger or grief or a number of others. But the fear one is the one I really started to learn on from the time I was a very young monk. Because, you know, to my knowledge, I'd never had just kind of like intense panic attacks until I started meditating. I think I'd probably been having them and wasn't really conscious of them so much. But when I became a monk and after I'd been meditating a while, I began to have, for a while it was like every morning at a certain time you'd set your watch by when the panic attack had hit. And it wouldn't be like a little bit of fear dribbling in. It would be like, hold on for dear life, this wave of intense terror coming through me. And then for an hour or two in that time, whatever I was doing, and usually that was my work time, so I was working usually, I would be just my meditation during that, I would be just meditating for dear life to get through that intense fear. During that period, you know, I was young, and I had a tremendous will to do this and to really apply the meditation. I really worked at it, and during that period, around an hour and a half to 2 hours after that wave of fear, which usually lasted maybe an hour or so, I would then have a equally intense wave of joy. And I didn't know it at the time. I couldn't have put it in words, but I was having my first kind of completely clear experience of what's called conversion. And that is that I was actually experiencing the kind of tail end, the feeling end of the conversion process. In actual fact, there was a deeply ingrained habitual way of looking at the world that was causing the fear. And that habitual way is deeply rooted in my what's called our karmic inheritance, not only this life, but also as I started to find after another year or two in past lives. And without knowing it, I was adopting attitudes habitually through the day that helped set me up for more of the fear down the road. Our actions, even if they're only actions of mind, lead eventually our moral actions affecting, you know, free moral choice, always culminate in states of feeling. So, when I started to apply the meditation and the bowing to the fear itself, I started to use the actual tail end of the what you might call the negative cause to turn the whole thing around in a positive direction. And this is an amazing thing about really applying meditation to your daily life. I mean, really applying it. It's incredibly hard work and doubly difficult in the world. You know, we're set up to really focus us at that in the monastery. The whole schedule is set up to help us do that. At any rate, the wonderful thing about applying it is you actually use what are your greatest weaknesses to help them become your greatest strengths. And no one is just stuck with some state of spiritual pain forever. There's something that can be done about it, but it has to be done at the level of the cause, not at the level of the effect. Another way to put that is when you are feeling a certain state of feeling, you can't just will that state of feeling away. And this is this is really noticeable, you know, when you're meditating. You really learn about this when you're meditating. You can distract yourself for a while, but if you really then become still again and focus inwards again, there it will be again. So, what do you do with it? You know, what is it that I was doing when that fear was hitting me that was different than what I've been doing my whole life, where I begin to experience this, the actual conversion? What was it doing differently? I was simply applying the fundamental principle of meditation to it, which is whatever there is, accept it and let it be there. Whatever is there, let it be there. Go back to pleasure and pain, liking and disliking, wanting more or less. Go right back to the pleasure and pain. If the pleasure is there, let it be there. It is the Buddha of the moment, whatever it is. If the pain is there, let it be there. It is a Buddha of the moment. Let it be. Let yourself feel it for what it is. My master, Rinpoche Master Jiyu, she said when I was a young monk, she was saying all the time, when it comes up and it hits you there in your meditation, embrace it. Don't turn your back on it. Don't try to turn your back on it. Embrace it. So, being young and very naive, I just tried to do that. I just tried to do that. Now, I would find that I'd be sitting in meditation, I'd be hit by this feeling, particular state of feeling, and I would just like, from my heart, from here, I would just kind of like open myself to that feeling and say, okay, if you're going to hit me, well, hit me full bore here. You know, I'd kind of like get a hold of my will and just open myself to it and let it plow into me. Otherwise, I would just sit there and be miserable trying to avoid it. And that's what I put into practice when I started having that fear hit me. I would be working, but I'd do the same thing. I'd let myself feel it. I'd let myself fully feel it, which is takes tremendous effort of concentration when the fear is really intense because it's so painful. But the thing is once you've kind of made yourself actually take that step of faith, that and you kind of have to believe that this actually is not going to destroy me, and that's it. That's it. You learn this when you really learn to meditate. That's the fear that underlies that. Is it if I let myself feel this, I will just be disintegrated by it. It will just destroy me. And what I found is actually no. It doesn't destroy you. It doesn't hurt you at all. And I would start to find that there was a stillness underneath it. And I could like go into this place underneath it that was still, and I'd be feeling it. And then at first I'd feel it really intensely. And then after a while, it would just be there as a state of feeling, and I'd be underneath it. So here's the thing that's really amazing. What is it that's teaching me to meditate? It isn't at that point, it's not your master, it's not the Buddha, it's not the rules for meditation, it's that fear. It is my teacher. So what does that make that fear then? That is the Buddha. It said in Buddhism, it said the kindest Kanzian is the bodhisattva of compassion, cosmic compassion, the kindest Kanzian appears in hell. What is that fear? Is the kindest Kanzan appearing in hell? What does that mean about this good and evil thing? What does it mean about the I am the kind of person who thing? They dissolve. What does it mean about the must have and must avoid? It dissolves. What does it mean even about the wanting? Well, okay, at this point, well, you're never going to be the kind of person who wants to be hit by the fear. To using fear as an example here, it's so painful. So at that point, you've got to just recognize your humanity. You're never going to be the kind of person who, if you're a sane person, who wants to be terrified. But it makes you not take it to these other levels. See? Which are the levels where suffering is increased. Because you do the things that actually make it, in the end, make the fear or whatever it is worse. More intense. And it'll just get as intense as it has to until it gets your attention. This is this really amazing pathway where the seemingly most anguished, confused aspects of our being are turned into the vehicles of enlightenment. That's why I so often say, so many of you have heard me say to, ad infinitum now, that the mystery of conversion, And by conversion, when I use the term, I'm not meaning, as my teacher, I don't mean changing from being a Christian to being a Muslim or a Buddhist. And that's not conversion, that's just change of religion. No, by conversion, I mean the actual transformation of the causes of suffering into the sources of enlightenment. And that is the greatest mystery of human life. That is the greatest mystery of existence. But when one gives oneself wholeheartedly to this practice, that is what one is made possible then. Therefore, the truly contemplative life is, as has been the view in Buddhism and Hinduism for thousands of years, it is the culmination of human life. The natural culmination of human life. You know about the kind of Hindu four stages of life? Childhood, young adulthood, then having the full responsibilities of adult life, and then retiring from the active life to the contemplative life. And to truly undertake and apply meditation to one's daily life, that is the highest human endeavor. And I'm not just saying that within Buddhism, the religious context within which you do it doesn't matter, so long as you find a practice that really works and a good teacher. In other words, one can do it as a Christian, and Christians have done it. One can do it as a Muslim. Muslims have done it. One can do it as a Buddhist. We're not, at the level I'm speaking of, we're not talking about religious labels. We're talking about, spiritual realities.